Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za. Point of View with Phimelo Mutine on Kaya 959. On the street, on the air.
It's 3 minutes after 8 o'clock. Welcome to Point of View. My name is Phimelo Mutine, and as you know, we are on our way to the elections, and we've been speaking to various political parties. And today we have none other than Bosa. I say Bosa. I know it's not. Build One South Africa leader Musi Maimane. We really appreciate you coming into studio. Thank you so much. Good evening and welcome.
No, good evening, and it's such a joy and a privilege to be here. Whenever you come to Kaya, you feel at home, and yes, that feels like you're talking to friends, and so it's great to be here.
Well, thank you. I am going to open the lines at some point because I think it's more important that people speak to you. We're going to speak a bit about your manifesto. We have, by the way, spoken to Ms. Webster about the manifesto.
Sure.
But I think there are other things that I think we'd like to hear from you. One of the biggest things that we've, Guga and I, in fact, was speaking about it earlier, is your posters, you know, a job in every home.
Yeah.
And it's a big one because South Africa at the moment, as you know, is reeling from this terrible, this economy that is just not recovering, right? In your view, you've been in government, you've seen it, you've seen the ups and downs. When did we actually, in your view, start dipping economically?
Look, I mean, in real numbers, no one can deny the fact that probably South Africa between 2000 and 2008 was showing very positive growth, GDP growth, mm-hmm. and then we had Lehman Brothers in 2008 collapse. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways, you know, you don't measure when an economy effectively had turned. It's that even in that period, one of the things we failed to do is when you had momentum with us, there were some structural things that we needed to do.
That's exactly what I'm asking.
Yeah.
Because, of course, we all know the actual points that are documented by media, yeah, and that are presented to us as fact.
Yeah.
But if you're inside, you almost get to see the train. Sure. It's coming.
Yeah.
It's coming. Hence, I asked the question.
So small things like whenever I think about an economy, and you are correct to answer the question, technically, how do you put a job in every home? Part of it is that you could see from a while away that the conditions upon which growth could be sustainable, mm-hmm, needed to be managed in the period of growth and weren't always. Mm-hmm. So, for example, South Africa was pre-warned about load shedding and we, mm-hmm, did nothing about it at the time, mm-hmm, which even if you started to build capacity with Kusile and Modupi, the net effect of it is that today, if you did nothing, we'd still be at the same place. So, mm-hmm, that is a whole wasteful expenditure. And that's, mm-hmm, why part of our jobs plan requires the fixing of Eskom. Transnet had been historically very corrupted even in that period. And so the movement of goods, both in ports and the movement of people, the collapse of passenger rail, almost began round about similar periods. Mm-hmm. You can even look at the biggest infrastructural build, which is maybe the net positive, was the ramp up towards the 2010 World Cup. Mm-hmm. And that kind of gave our economy a sense of buffering, mm, because we kind of were investing in there was massive expenditure, mm, going into the thing. But the dilemma with it is that whilst priority spend was put towards infrastructure for the World Cup, mm-hmm, we didn't kind of do priority spend on other infrastructure. Water as an example. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Johannesburg has got its own dilemmas. Mm. I don't think we did enough to reform our education. So the skilling component of our economy has become something that lagged behind. Mm. We proved the simple theory that says if you invest in policing and you increase the number of cops, you prioritize murder, mm, it starts to decrease. And we did that prior to 2010. Mm-hmm. And then after 2010, we kind of extracted that. And naturally, communities are not feeling safe. Mm. And then lastly, the concentration of where the infrastructure build was meant that part of our economic growth wasn't spread out. So if you are in a township, whether it be Alexandra, Soweto, and many other parts, the infrastructure build, for example, broadband, as a simple example, I don't think was as prioritized as it could have been. So those economies have suffered. And so that's on the one conditions dynamic of the issue. The investment in SMMEs, I think the last time we had a policy document that directed us economically as a country was probably post-ASGISA. Mm. We started to talk about the NGP and then we talked about the NDP. And all of those documents started to gather dust. No one read them. Nothing happened. And I don't like the term wasted years, because I think it locates economic demise on one president, whilst in truth, there was a whole organization that managed this. So now what we've really got to do as South Africans is say to ourselves, what is the shared consensus? And that's why we've focused on the jobs plan to say, let that be, let it be something we can workshop with various role players. And furthermore from that, the priority must be, how do we put a job in every home? Mm-hmm. I'm clear in my head. We'll never be able, we won't in the short term be able to achieve full employment, which is employment at less than 6%. But at least what we can do is prioritize the bringing about of 2 million jobs, which will make sure they are aggregated across every household, so that at least in a home, there's someone who gets up every morning to go to work. That is absolutely vital, because if you've lived in a house where no one gets up to go to work, I can assure you, children are going to drop out of school. Mm. Violence is going to increase in that home. And let alone the questions around poverty. Mm. It means the only dependent is the fact that that family is dependent on either welfare or remittances that come from somewhere. So
when you say home, you mean the bricks and mortar of a structure where there are a number of people are living, and somebody in that house has to get up and go to work.
Someone has to do that. And why I've also taken a home as the metaphor is because... You know, one, on a justice level, what the apartheid government sought to do is dismantle the black home.
Mm-hmm.
In all fairness, it asked fathers to go work in mines elsewhere. It asked mothers to become domestic workers elsewhere, which meant kids ended up raising kids. And that has had its own social consequences. Those we cannot fix for post-apartheid, because in all reality, if people die in Marikana, the widows are in the north, in the Eastern Cape. And so it tells you the problem that we have socially, because we know from research that if kids don't have an adult at home that will help them, they don't stay at school. We know. I lived in Dobsonville and in Soweto. I can assure you, as night follows day, almost in our entire street, there isn't a young female who's not pregnant. So when we talk about some of the social ills, we must accept that there's been a dismantling of the black family, more specifically. So that's why I also don't talk about just a job in every home. It's a job closer to home. Because to fix for the ills of apartheid, we can't have someone living kilometers away from home, spending 40% of their income in transport. This is a challenge. We've got to fix for that. But on a second issue, government has adopted this policy that says that we prioritize the under 35s. And I can appreciate that youth unemployment is a ticking time bomb. So I accept that point. But in all reality, if you are living in a household where there isn't a 35-year-old, what does that family do? What is their pathway out of poverty? And what happens when you live in a home where there are only under 35 sisters, favored, etc.? So I really do think we must rethink society on the basis of going, how do we stabilize the home? How do we make sure communities work better? And ultimately, how do we ensure that economic vibrancy, particularly in our township, is restored or actually built? If we don't get those things right, I can assure you, you can fix for the macroeconomic, you can fix for certain bulk projects that you've got to put, but you'll always continually be dealing with violent homes, kids that drop out of school, and invariably a society that is unstable.
So where do you begin? Because that's a lot. That's a lot to prioritize at the same time.
Of course.
Where do you begin?
Yeah, I think you have to start it at an economic conversation. There's no doubt about that. Because, you know, naturally, you know, I grew up in a home where my mother wasn't working most of our high school. So I get the additional stress it puts in a single income home. And there are too many in South Africa like that. I could be going to school. I could be doing many other things. But without additional income, it made a whole lot of other things much tougher. So naturally, that's why we've located our economic message on, let's put a job in every home. I think it's the just and the right thing to do. And we've got to fix for our economy, because hungry people cannot learn, and hunger is the surest way to rob people of their dignity. So let's get people working, and let's ensure we fix our economy. And I'm saying it's a 2 million jobs question. And if all of us, we bring all stakeholders, we say we focus on this one task, mm-hmm. whatever bills we pass, let them be able to create jobs. Whatever education process we put on the table, it can't just be education for education's sake. It has to be education skilled for job creation. If we focus on safety, we say, is it partly going to result in better investment in our township? Mm-hmm. That's got to be the laser focus of government. That's mm-hmm. got to be the consensus we built for all our players.
I see. So what you're saying is you're not just looking at these policies need to direct their energies at empowering the jobs and the economy.
Completely.
To gear up this economy in the right direction.
Completely. And you've When a teacher gets up to educate a child in a classroom, mm-hmm. you're not educating kids. We all accept the intrinsic value of education. Mm-hmm. But we haven't worked hard to articulate the extrinsic value of education, which is, am I linking this child to a job? I'm still shocked. There are children who finish school who can't, in some instances, work hard, do a computer or whatever. Mm. We've made TVET colleges dropout zones. Mm-hmm. You know, when you hear all
the
work with TVET,
alternative,
we say, they've dropped out because mm-hmm. everyone must go to university mm. and go do a BA degree. Mm. And I'm not undermining BA degrees because I did one. That was my first degree. Mm. So I ain't dissing it in that sense. But what I want to say is there must be an aspiration to say a child who goes into TVET, mm-hmm. who now eventually does a skills-based qualification, that be plumbing, that be engineering, that be motor mechanics, that be, they are as esteemed in society as a child who goes and does a degree at university. Mm. So that there's a sense upon which we are continuously answering the question, those young people, are they going to find jobs? And what jobs are they going to create? That's got to be the principal focus we put on the table.
So there's a lot you'd have to do, and I see the global view, because you would have to start with industry seeing those people as people who bring value to this economy, who cannot be undermined, whose skills can be properly rewarded, and that's not necessarily the case. You would have to redirect everyone's lens to appreciating every skill at every level, including a domestic worker.
Yeah, and I think in many ways part of the failure of Parliament is also creating laws that help our economy, whether it's certain regulation. That's why I find it frustrating when I hear parties say, we're going to scrap the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. You don't understand what the minimum wage means. Someone is earning just over 4,000 rand, even currently. And so I don't understand when someone says they've got to scrap that. Are they trying to propose that someone must dip below that and still support a family? It's insanity, right? And this is important for sectors like domestic workers, where you can't get away with not paying your domestic worker less than 5 grand a month. It's just simply, there's something about a morality issue that you must confront, but there's a legislative component to the issue. But also, it means that broadly in other sectors, when you talk about them being seen, we must also be able to reward it economically.
Yes.
If you've ever tried to, I always use my doctor. My doctor went and studied for a number of years. If I have an online consult with them just because I'm traveling and I need something quickly, they can't charge me more than 400 rands for the consult, because that's what not only medical aids prescribe, but it's what is the going rate. Mm-hmm. But you try and call a plumber for less than 400 rands and see where you end up. You are not getting one. Mm-hmm. So you get a good plumber, they're going to arrive there at 600 rands and 700 rands to come and do the work, because it's a specialized skill. So I think we need to also recognize it economically and see the opportunities that are there. And the language we use towards it, particularly artisans, skilled workers, cannot be language that we kind of say, when are we in that?
Shame.
It's got to be language of esteem, because if you are looking at this economy, if you arrived in Australia, Australia can do with less doctors. They need artisans. They need skills. If you're looking at the South African economy, I think that we've become applauders of 12% of our society that end up to university, and we applaud it, and that's important. I'm not denying that, but I'm just saying let's also esteem the motor mechanic, the engineer who comes in, and let's also ensure that along with that, one of the things that we failed to do is that when I think about the township economy, having lived in the township, you ask anyone, they can call into the show. You drive a BMW, you have a choice. Sometimes you can take it to the dealership or somebody who knows what that car needs in the township. Part of us esteeming people like that is helping to invest in those businesses. Let us set up shops in townships where people can fix high-end vehicles, support them with capital, give them social capital so that we have a job closer to home. So my buzz and my energy is about making sure permanently we have jobs at least closer to home and a job in every home, and ensuring that actually we give dignity to people economically.
So because you have been engaging with a lot of other stakeholders outside of politics, you know where the bottlenecks are. We don't invest in those people because, number one, the establishment does not certify them so that I can go to them and be insured by the establishment. If I want to stay in the system, I better go to where they're sending me to, which is in Sandton. Mm. So my uncle may be an artisan and exceptional at that, but my uncle is not getting on that database. Mm. It doesn't matter what I think of my uncle's skills. Mm. And so it's much bigger than you and my will of assisting the township economy. So what are those stakeholders saying who keep out people like my uncle?
Part of it is in some ways the lack of infrastructure in certain places. So if you went to Vilakazi Street tomorrow morning and load shedding has gone on holiday for the elections and it'll return.
Did you just say for the elections?
It's just for the elections. I can tell you that now. May the 30th, stage two. It's like, this is where I'm going. But let's presume, when I speak to entrepreneurs who are in Vilakazi Street, you say to them, what happens when there's load shedding? Mm-hmm. They can't process payments.
Yes.
Just payment points. That's a basic thing. Which means any tourist who's not arriving with local currency cannot pay. Mm. So there are infrastructural issues we have to build to make sure that it's easy for what I like to call not only a township economy, but an economy from the township. Mm-hmm. Because anyone who manufactures anything from the township, surely the township market isn't big enough. They need to be consumed elsewhere. But let's take banking as a simple example. One of the things I've spent quite a bit of time doing is writing to all the respective banks and say to them, what capital allocation have you got for SMMEs? Mm-hmm. What equity or asset base do you consider? Because someone may very well own a house in Dobsonville in Soweto, but they are never going to be able to leverage that as an asset to be able to trade against. So we need banking to be able to rethink how it does its credit model, and the state needs to be very deliberate about those issues. Issues like pricing. Mm. So let me take the person who runs a spaza shop. Mm. When bread lands in the township, what the Competition Commission was meant to simply have done is to regulate that Pick and Pay, thanks to bulk buying, cannot drop bread at a lower price than what a spaza shop will be able to do, so that there's fair competition. So all of these types of dynamics, we need to ensure that not only do we regulate for, we fund the infrastructure built for, but we legislate and direct the private sector to, in order to facilitate behavior that we want. Because what South Africa's biggest dilemma, and that's why when I started Build One South Africa and Build One Economy, is because I feared that we have a dual economy. Mm-hmm. There's a formalized economy upon which people have different trading rules at some level. And there's an informal one, which I'm not asking for it to be burdened by regulation. Mm-hmm. All I'm simply asking is that let us treat these economies as one that feeds into each other so that we can build one shared economy, so that more and more people can participate. And so invariably, we've got to be deliberate to South Africa. That's why this consensus building issue is absolutely important, and a government that's capable to direct that, because no president is going to be able to come into South Africa and fail just the basic task of being able to go, how do I use my available assets? Hmm. You want to force the insurance companies to say to them, listen, I can put all the process of insurance here, or I can direct you to put insurance and motor vehicle fixing in these communities. I insist that you do that, and we'll make it conditional to your license allocation, because as the state, we are the issuers of the license.
Let's take a quick break. 086-00-00959. That's where you can dial in. You can also send a voice note on 063-688-0959. Asmusi Maimane is my guest, leader of Build One South Africa. He's in studio with us. And this is a great opportunity for you actually to ask your questions. 086-00-00959. 0959. You can also send a voice note on 0636880959. You can send an X too. I see a lot of your X's. I'm going to go straight to one. Mr. My Money. One coming from Wendy Isaacs, and it says, well, agreed on the jobs are important, but beyond this national level focus, please comment on the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement and BRICS expectations for job creations there.
Yeah. Look, I mean, Africa still today presents a very powerful pathway for South Africa, given that by 2040, population growth in Africa should be about 1.4 billion people, which is a massive opportunity. And the only job that any self-respecting, you know, African Union has to focus on is about moving 300 million people from poverty to the middle class. Otherwise, the problems will become serious. So there are a couple of massive opportunities. That's it. One of them is being able to establish a centralized Africa pharmacology center so that we can patent our own vaccines and be able to do that. Secondly, we have a massive opportunity in environmental and climate sustainable solutions. So if you think about SADC, we've got big opportunities around a SADC grid as far as energy is concerned, so that you can use things like gas and particularly from Mozambique and various parts of those of the world, but also in minerals that are available for battery technology. So palladium, the very minerals we used for building of batteries, mm-hmm. is going to be important to come out of here. I also do think the third dynamic is we've got opportunities to fund infrastructure. That the biggest dilemma between even the free trade agreement, mm-hmm. is that logistics have become difficult in Africa.
Yes.
So it's very easy to move goods
outside of the continent.
So it's harder for me to send goods to Senegal than it is for me to send them to China.
Mm-hmm.
So let's make things like, for example, border control, border traffic easier, mm-hmm. to manage by building appropriate infrastructure, so that if I want to move goods from here to Zambia, to Zimbabwe, etc., it's easier. And that's about, and equally so, the movement of people. How do we adjudicate for visas? How do we make sure that we give all of that confidence in Africa so that it's easier to intra-trade? Mm. Nigerians should not be drinking, and I say to them, Nigerians should not be drinking French wine. Mm. They must drink South African wine. Mm. In the same way as us in South Africa need to be learning from countries like Kenya, mm. about how do we do transactional payment points and things like M-Pesa, etc. Mm. I do think we haven't, as South Africa, had a proper conversation about Africa. I'm as much a Pan-Africanist as the next person is, but I'm also very deliberate about saying Africa needs a leadership that can ensure that Africa's prosperity is on the table.
So what's the problem?
We have two dilemmas. One, we've got African leaders who have surrendered their sovereignty, mm-hmm. so you end up with extraction of minerals, mm-hmm. without locus of control, mm-hmm. and you end up with corrupt leaders, mm-hmm. who are bought elsewhere, mm-hmm. and actually their sole job is to manage resources, mm-hmm. moving out. And then secondly, Africa is heavily indebted.
Mm-hmm.
So the dilemma with a very indebted Africa is that it means that simply you are looking for cheap capital, mm-hmm. coming from elsewhere, so mm-hmm. you get very predatory states, mm-hmm. and some of them, I'm not mm-hmm. anti-Chinese, mm-hmm. but the fact of the matter is that when I look at the debt structuring on what happened in Zambia as an example, these are good examples of what happens when predatory capital comes into play, extracts resources, and then keeps you on long-term debt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not unique to the Chinese. It's also true for some of the EU member states. And so we've got to have to, as Africa, create a centralized fund, think hard about how do we invest. And so if BRICS offers us an opportunity to create the capital inflow so that Africa can be able to have a sense of control about its own destiny, be able to fund its own infrastructural growth without these long-term debt gearing, which ends up a country like South Africa's debt burden is quite high, as an example. So I do think instruments like that need to be built.
You've seen at the AU, though, Francophone Africa and Anglophone Africa, it's tough.
Of course,
it's tough for them to see eye to eye. I mean, you've got to at least get that right.
And the opportunity is there. I think, you know, I was in Senegal and looking at Francophone countries. there's still a looking to what South Africa can do here in this instance. There's still a thinking about these issues because the opportunities are moving closer to the continent. Mm. As conflict is arising elsewhere, if you think about how many African states were treated during COVID, are being treated between Russia and Ukraine, are being treated in the conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Gaza. So all of those issues mean that as new channels for transport are being opened, as new financing models, South Africa, we have to take a very important role as it pertains to this issue. That's but just on one component. But furthermore, we also must think about how do we incorporate countries, particularly the sort of northern Arab countries, Egypt, Tunisia, etc., because the economic growth and GDP numbers are starting to tick up. And so it gives us an opportunity to enter trade in that regard. So I think I'm the eternal optimist when it comes to collaboration across. I also think that without trying to just harmonize for Africa's sake, you also have an opportunity when I think about the southern part of Africa to build what is similar to ASEAN, which is a kind of conglomeration of a number of these countries, building of capital so that we can fund for infrastructural growth. And I think there's something I'm very jealous about. You know, in Francophone countries, if one country loses its democratic impetus, the rest gather together, whether it's Nigeria, they were able to fight off issues in the Gambia, Senegal right now, we've seen a change. Here in Southern Africa, we instead send our president to go to Zimbabwe to go congratulate a leader who's been elected where the Zambian counterpart has already declared the fact that these elections were not free and fair, yet we go in there and celebrate the madness that's going on.
So in real terms, SADC is quite small, actually.
Sure.
Why can't it get its act together?
It's the failure of South African leadership, to be honest with you. I think that many SADC countries, and I've engaged SADC because we set up a South African Partnership for Democratic Change with many opposition leaders there. So we are quite well versed with what happens in Zambia, Zimbabwe, Namibia, Mozambique, Malawi, and the dilemma that sits in those countries is that they all look to South Africa. We've got a very sophisticated economy. They're very clear about the fact that we play an international, a very important role. Certainly, even coming up this year, South Africa will be the chair of the G20. So there's an esteem that South Africa has put. But we failed leadership. We failed the basic task of being able to bring everybody together. And where we needed to act, we've acted for personal interests, whether it's the use of our own military interventions, or whether it's the deployment of capital, or whether it's even envisioning our own businesses in South Africa to say, before you start to lead trade missions to Washington, to the UK, let's go to Zimbabwe, let's go invest there. Because you can't say you have an immigration problem until you are willing to solve it at source. Say, what's going on in Zimbabwe, let's go engage there, Zambia, etc. I think South Africa has failed SADC. In the same way as Nigeria has an important role to play in East Africa, South Africa has an important role to play here, and I think we failed profoundly in this regard.
You spoke about security as we could look at 2010 and what South Africa was able to do. Was that model sustainable? I mean, all efforts, I suppose, were concentrated in the urban centers, and we all put the resources there. Would it be sustainable to keep that kind of order for a prolonged period of time?
It should have been. And I think that we've allowed it to get so far out of hand that now we have to think hard about how we deal with security. I've proposed that we need to decentralize policing.
Okay.
So you have a combination of what is cross-border policing and regionalized policing. And by the reason you want regionalized policing is to do a few things. The first is you've got to bring intelligence lower down to the ground. The reality of it is that it's important to know where your criminals are coming from, what the systemic causes of crime are, and therefore you need to bring it at a much more lower level, because I don't think we are giving birth to new criminals every day. I think criminals are committing new crimes every day because they're not getting arrested. In South Africa, people are obsessed with the nature of the punishment and they forget the perception of being caught. Criminals in this country don't feel they're going to get caught. And I want to send a strong message to say to them, bring on a new government, you will get caught. The second thing is we've got to merge Metro Police with this regionalized police force. And why you do that is because I get frustrated by being stopped by Metro Police who are asking to check my license disc. What a wasteful use of manpower in a country that's got other pressing priorities, i.e. murder, gender-based violence.
And their roles are so limited.
You know, so bring those two together and broaden the mandate so that when you think about Johannesburg, you think about city centres like eThekwini, Cape Town, etc., you can be much more aggressive on that. And then the third aspect is create a public-private partnership between the police and private security guards, because now for the first time in a long time, in fact in the history of democratic South Africa, we've got more private security than we do public security. But you've got to mandate powers that are able to say, actually what we are going to do is Uberize the response of policing. So in essence, you and I are sitting at home, a crime is triggered, we dial 10111.
The closest
vehicle must respond so that we are quick to intervene and we can create the improvement of saying, if you do the crime, you are going to get caught. Because then the collection, what you then do is you free up your detectives to prioritize what they need to investigate. You speak to any detective in the police, they'll tell you, I've got to deal with a motor vehicle accident, deal with murder, deal with rape, deal with all of that, which means they never specialize in anything, but also their workload is just increased. The ratio of policing to citizen, international benchmarking is 1 is to 350. What eventually happens in this country, Dobsonville, my community, it's 1 is to 1,200, which means the policeman is never going to do anything effective. Let's keep them together so that they can focus on the things they can do, be effective at collection of evidence, capacitate magistrate courts, because everyone talks about, we've got such a great judicial system, we often are referring to the Kong Court and the SCA, but we fail to see that there's a magistrate court where we've got to ensure that petty crime, when people feel like there's assault or all of those issues, those are reported and dealt with effectively, and the police are able to present evidence that makes sure people are locked up. So it's an issue of a combining of the perception that you are going to get arrested, and when you are arrested, there must be a deep sense that we will secure a conviction, and we must incentivize policing for those, because you can't live in a country where the conviction rate for murder is sub 20%. That is insane. It means you've got a 4 in 5 chance of getting away with murder.
How concerned are you with organized crime? What we are seeing to be quite complex organized crime now, that we are seeing in the mining sector, in many other areas. Copper has become quite a commodity that we are exporting larger than anything. We don't even mine copper in this country.
Yeah.
How concerned are you about that?
Of course. And I think it's about the operation of syndicates broader. Mm. You know, so I often say to people, someone asked me, what would keep you awake if you became the president of the country? It's that. Mm-hmm. As it's organized mafia type crime.
Yes.
Because it's not just the copper. It's also illicit drugs.
Yes.
It's also capital outflows. Mm-hmm. That's why partly South Africa's got grey listing and all of those issues. Mm-hmm. And the biggest dilemma around that is that it finds political cover for corrupt practices. So you find that there are certain politicians who are quite okay with receiving money from proceeds of drugs or proceeds of corruption, and therefore they buy cover for those people. And that's something that deeply worries me, because you can't ask criminals to catch other criminals.
Yeah, but you're going to have to do something about that. What would you do?
Clean out the state. I mean, I think what we've lost as a country...
Because I suspect what you're saying is... We do know where the criminals are, actually.
We do know where the criminals are.
It's whether we want to catch the criminals and what that actually means.
Inherently, you've got a problem of politicians who buy cover.
Mm-hmm.
So my first 100-day plan is to say, if you do anything for this country, fix the capability of the state. Make sure that your National Police Commissioner is someone who has risen through the ranks of police. Make sure that your minister of police is someone who you can bring from outside. Look at all the variables that deal with prevention.
What do you mean from
outside? So in other words, the Constitution prescribes that the president is able to elect two members to the executive who haven't been elected through the processes. I think if I was to pick two...
Politically so, you mean?
Politically so. So I could pick an expert in security and be able to bring them through and say, I want to prioritize you leading the police, and let's get a police commissioner who has come through the police ranks. So that, and then along with the interventions I've mentioned around devolving of police powers, et cetera, actually create a crime prevention strategy that says, even in communities, you can rotate policemen. Because once police become familiar with the crooks,
sometimes they become part of the system.
Part of the problem.
Do you have faith in the current police minister?
No, not at all. I think Peggy Cele has failed. I mean, you know, in South Africa, you only lose confidence in people when they are found to be corrupt. We don't lose confidence in people when they're found to be incompetent. And I know the term incompetent sometimes denotes, No, the truth is, if I hire you, if we're a football club and I hire you to score goals and you don't score goals as a striker, you are incompetent, right? Let's just face the fact. If I employ you to become a minister of police to be able to ensure that crime decreases, the fact on the table is that crime has increased progressively over the last while. And so the minister of police is ineffective and thus incompetent. So I don't have confidence in him, and I actually am uncertain given some allegations around issues like the grabber, issues about how certain police cases have been handled. I think he himself might be compromised, and I think this is something we must take to heart. Since the Marikana case, one of the things that I think it was Judge Farlam who chaired the Marikana Commission highlighted was, in fact, that the police leadership is poor, our ability to do public order policing is poor, and ultimately, when you look at the ecosystem of policing, we've never, since even such heinous and painful incidents like Marikana, like all the tragedies we face, policing has never been reformed. And so we still are living in what is an apartheid-style policing where it's almost to keep particular suburbs protected from townships rather than, in fact, introducing things like technology to fight crime, being much more deliberative about saying, how do we keep the criminals away from locked up?
I would like to ask Musi Maimane, what's different about his party from the DA that he was in previously, and what he's planning to do about the guns that are on our streets, killing our brothers, killing our kids?
All right, Mr. Maimane.
There are some significant differences. I think the DA has become a minority party. It's really focused on the interests of minorities. It doesn't have a vision for all South Africans, particularly black South Africans.
Minority as in white?
Almost. I mean, it claims that it would include Indian and coloured in the midst of that, but I don't even think those interests matter in that sense. So
when did that change?
It became progressively harder. In fact, I'm bringing out a book, if I'm going to advertise on this show, but I'm bringing out a book precisely because when I went into the DM, when Tony Leon was leader of the DA, they introduced a policy called Fight Back. You'll remember that election campaign.
Fight Back, which was understood to be Fight Black.
Yeah, and it became a consolidation of minorities. And at the time, it merged with the National Party. So when I took leadership of the DA, one of the things we were very intentional about doing is we were very clear that we needed to build a base upon which black South Africans and South Africans in general could work together in a collective. Secondly, we wanted to diversify the caucus. I was very clear about the fact that we needed to grow in communities that we didn't typically grow in. And more than anything, I needed to invest more in ensuring that our policy framework was one that was just and more inclusive. That's why in the constitution of the DA introduced diversity. It's why we focused on those laws.
Just a minute. There was the black caucus in the DA, was there not?
There was. It wasn't an official one.
Yes, I know. Were you not part of that?
No. Well, when you lead an organization at some point, particularly one that is across all racial groups, you also need to be able to lead all South Africans. Mm-hmm. And so when I took over as leadership, whilst I had many South Africans who were black and I was part of that caucus in the beginning, I also wanted to not be associated exclusively with that caucus because I wanted to lead all South Africans. That's why when I left, I started Build One South Africa. No one in the DA said, no, but that's our thing, because they know it's not their thing. So the net effect of it is that when we lost votes to the Freedom Front Plus in 2019, the sense was inside the DA, no, you need to go back and find those Afrikaans voters. And then policy framework like the DA adopted, they call it being colorblind, but all it meant was it was racism blind or racial injustice blind, which is more difficult. when you look at its leadership now, it's all Lily White. And so I actually think that the DA has become more right-wing in some ways than maybe parties that are in that space. I think it's occupying that space. And that's why adverts like the burning flag don't surprise me at all, because they come out of a camp that says, we are here now. We're not trying to write a chapter of the South African story post the ANC. We are saying, if we are not in it, South Africa must burn. That's effectively the subtitle behind this issue. And so that was one of the things, and it became harder to reconcile a vision for all South Africans and a vision for that. We worked hard. I think we're making success. I thought we were really making good progress. And yeah, sure, you, the road to a reconciled non-racial, multiracial South Africa, it's never a straight path. You are going to suffer some losses along the way. And I, as a leader, will concede that. But it was all for the good. I'm so grateful that, looking back at it now, I've had time to rethink what I'd like to do for South Africa. Mm-hmm. Spent the last 5 years not only writing, but also studying, being in business, but figuring out some of the things that we need to do. So I feel I'm coming back a stronger individual in that sense.
You say, and I suppose this is why people want to know, you know, what distinguishes you to where you come from. You say these were things that were happening back in Tony Leon's time. And, well, you're saying they've become quite a minority party now.
Yeah.
Who's responsible for that?
Well, what's happened is that's what I was defining, that crucial period in 2019 in a unique election. Mm-hmm. This was Ramaphosa, this was all of that. When those Afrikaans voters went back to the Freedom Front Plus, and the motivation by people like John Steenhuisen to come in, who is very enamored with the project that Tony Leon was leading and the relationship there, his leadership and their sense of creating a conditions within the DA that were highly toxic, it became a place where you could see an exodus of black leaders, and that's been happening. And it's going to continue to happen. But that's not the only distinctive. The major distinctive that we've brought on is that the DA is an old party like the ANC. So its model of working is still archaic. We've gone out and said, let's empower communities and get candidates that come from communities. That's a very key distinctive place. We're different in terms of policy. We recognize injustices of the past. And so part of the work that we do is, I'm not blind to the issue of race. And in fact, I'm proud to be black. I'm in a mixed race relationship. My wife's a white South African. My kids don't come home and say, wait till you know we don't see color. My kids are clear. Mommy is white. Daddy is black. Rona, we identify like this. And so they're clear in their heads. They even tell me.
And how do they identify?
You know, it's an interesting conversation, because I think they realize that maybe in the census forms there isn't one that categorizes mixed race in that sense. I think they class themselves in that way because they're not colored in the historical context of the issue or the current context of the issue. So I think they'd probably take black more than anything. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important for them to realize, or when they go to Soweto and Dobsonville and they find Gogo there or Nkunwabone, they must know why Gogo ended up here as a function of history. They must also know, when they go visit Granny, who happens to be a white South African in a white suburb, to know, how did Granny end up here? Mm. These things are not abnormal in our homes. We discuss them. Mm. It's a discussion that we take, so much so that my kids will be the first ones to fight on issues that say, if there's a lack of justice, how do we fight for it? In fact, my daughter was one of the ones who were wanting to fight for free higher education, and a position that even I was like, okay, you are there, because she asked the question, why is it that kids are not getting a free quality education? So she's pushed on that. My son would be very intentional, even at looking at sport, he's quite a keen sportsman, to say it can't just be white players on the field, it needs to be a diversity of players. Mm-hmm. So we've become intentional about that as a family.
So someone on X is asking the question, if you had to go into a coalition, I'm assuming now you are saying you wouldn't talk to the DA, or am I wrong?
No. I think in this instance, whilst I'm describing why I left the DA, that doesn't mean I hold the grudge. It's a bit like when you get divorced. You don't look at your ex and, you know. Leadership is about recognizing that your own issues cannot be the altar upon which you sacrifice a country. The only, my primary response to what I would who I would coalesce with is mm-hmm. predicated on we have a 10-point plan, mm-hmm. which is how do we fix Eskom, how do we fix Transnet, how do we fix education, how do we solve for crime, how do we build a capable state with ethical leaders, how do we eradicate corruption, all of those. That's in the 10-point plan. I'm unapologetic about that. We will not work with people who don't agree on that plan, mm-hmm. of which one of the conditions is that if you are corrupt, we can't talk to you. Hmm. So, because you can't fight corruption with people that are corrupt. But at the same time, if you are racist, we can't talk to you. We can't fight racism with people who are racist. So, parties that we engage with need to be able to, at least for us, as principal conditions, be able to overcome those. And so I think there are some parties that by virtue of that, you'll notice that will eliminate themselves.
These corrupt people, would they have to be fingered already by the police
or we must just
suspect that they're corrupt?
They are black, green and gold. No, but...
Only?
Not only that. But I mean, I think we... You know, if I'm being blunt about this issue, I do think South Africa is due a grand coalition of the opposition. I really do think so. I think it's the best pathway. It stops us from capturing the state in a coalition environment. I think it allows us to be able to pick the best cabinet from various parties. And ultimately, it means that rather than being ideologues, we can focus on a plan so that the president is accountable for the plan. And there are certain things I don't even agree with the EFF on, but I do think it's a worthwhile conversation to have with the EFF, mm-hmm. because even if we don't agree, but there may be certain aspects that, as I saw in Johannesburg, you'll remember we set up the coalition in 2016. I didn't agree with everything Julius wanted, but the truth is I was willing to listen to him. Yes. He was really hearing me out. And where the interests align, he was willing to vote in that, and we could pass budgets and issues like that. I think that the ANC needs time to renew itself. The ANC has been in government for 30 years. They've become drunk with power. I don't think they can sober up whilst with a credit card at the bar. It's never happened. So it's not about hatred of the ANC. It's that the ANC has become so captured with liberation politics that it can't see beyond that. That's why it's inviting ZANU-PF. That's why it interferes in areas where it shouldn't be. And that's why its leadership is aged and archaic. We need to give them time to go knit with their children, and some of them end up in jail for the crimes they've committed.
Bongani is calling from Soweto. Good evening and welcome, Bongani.
Good evening, and good evening to the KFM listener.
Good evening.
Musi, Musi, you spoke about the coalition that probably could take place and where the ANC is currently drunk in terms of the democracy, and it probably could take its time to be sober. Let's say they take Bosa to be our government. And in terms of strategizing the governing of South Africa, where will Bosa start? And where will Bosa get the finance to make sure that the transformation that you think the ANC fails to do, then Bosa could take it within a blink of an eye?
Nothing in government is ever in a blink of an eye, my brother. But let me just start with the first instance, right? I tabled last week outside the union buildings a restructuring of government. And I looked at a 10-point plan that said, here's some of the things that we've got to do. Chief amongst those is a partnership I want to create with a public service commission to say, give us the rubric and the specs as to what the various portfolios need to look like, mm-hmm. right? Because it's important that if you want an engineer at Eskom, I need to get an engineer, not a medical doctor. Mm. As qualified as a medical doctor is, but I actually need an engineer, and et cetera, et cetera. The example applies to all sectors. Mm-hmm. So the first starting point is to work with the Public Service Commission to ensure that we create the state. The minimization of cabinet, because you asked me the question about where we find the resources. At this point in time, we've got a state that consumes its own resources because of its bloated nature. So let's minimize cabinet so that we free up some resources to be able to fund for development. Furthermore, we've got to ensure that we focus on some of the issues around GDP growth so that we increase the amount of money that's available so that it's not all spent on debt, mm-hmm. but it's on investment on future projects. So, Bongani, to your point, mine is to say smaller government, smaller cabinet, mm-hmm. not smaller
cabinet,
because those two things aren't always synonymous. And furthermore, make sure that you do much more preventative work, even around issues of corruption, because I've already proposed that even in the office of the president, I want to create an ombudsman of an executive ethics so that you're not reporting these cases of corruption to the public protector later. Whereas people, if you want a trip, if you are in cabinet, you will get a lifestyle audit that is public. But you'll also come in, if you want to take your family on a holiday on the jet of the government, go apply and someone can say yes or no. And we say no, we refuse. So that we're not dealing with count post the thing. If you want to receive a gift from Gavin Watson, whoever you want to receive a gift for, go declare it up front. Say, this person wants to give me a gift. We say no, it's done.
And I'm still with the leader of Build One South Africa, Musi Maimane, in studio with us. Very, very graciously allowed us to take more time. I want to quickly go to an ex that is asking you about, please, as South Africans, we need to know if your position on the South Africa versus Israel genocide case remains the same. Is it a misstep? Was it a misstep? And what are your views now? And have you reviewed your position?
Look, as difficult as it is, in the middle of the conflict between Israel and Hamas, that I certainly hold the absolute view that we have to do everything we can to find a two-state solution, as difficult as that is. It's a historical position from the 1960s. It's been worked on. And I think that as tough as it is, we've still got to pursue it. I am not here to determine whether it's genocide. That is a matter of the courts to do. And I've been engaged, certainly, with the Arab League and various countries that have come through to say that how do we deal with this issue? And they are engaged with the subject. I also do think that we've got to do everything we can to stop the suffering on certainly the citizens in Gaza. I really think that a ceasefire is crucial. A ceasefire is crucial.
How is it going to happen?
We need to figure out the best ways to return hostages. And ultimately, the role that the international community has to be able to do, and this is where South Africa can play a constructive role, is to bring both sides together to a negotiated settlement where ultimately it's not done through the bullet, but it's done through a peaceful transition, as we had to work out even in the midst of apartheid, and free up all mechanisms to ensure that aid of any kind is brought forward. And I think recognize the fact that the right for Palestine to exist is important, and the right for Israel to exist is important. And having been to both sides, I recognize the issues that have gone on for a while, but I do think this is still, for me, the pathway forward towards a peaceful solution. I think we should uphold that. And no doubt that where the atrocities being committed on either end, those need to cease. And I think we need to be able to deal with how we deal with Hamas and all those kinds of issues that are happening in the region.
A question says, you haven't answered the question about who you'd partner with in the event that you have to form a coalition.
I think I was very clear about the who is not the issue here. Mm. The what is the issue. The worst thing we can do is partner with anybody and fail to govern better than the current state. Mm. So I've eliminated some people on the basis of the corrupt. I've already stated that a grand coalition of the opposition must be on the table, and that not everybody is going to be part of that formal coalition, but they may use their votes to sponsor certain things. Let me use the EFF as an example, or use anyone else. They might say, look, we don't agree with what you are putting on the table, but what we are willing to do is to say, maybe we want to elect a presiding officer, we want to elect the president, we want to pass the budget. All of those issues can be negotiated without having it. Could be a minority government in that sense, but I certainly think a grand coalition of the opposition is necessary.
The president tomorrow is signing into law the NHI. Your response to that?
I think this is actually a very dangerous thing to do in this country. The first principle that I don't want us to lose in my opposition to this current bill is that I think that we must improve access to healthcare. No one can deny that. I think to create a single-payer model is dangerous, which is what this bill seeks to do. It will be bloated and expensive. We have a government who has shown that anytime you pull money into one central place, it cannot administer it. But even if you were to set this government aside, models of healthcare that are working globally are hybrid models, where you have a combination of both public and private. You have the state as a reinsurer in that instance. So for me, my vision in the long run is a hybrid model. It says to ourselves at primary healthcare level, the state can underwrite healthcare so that if you are not, if you're feeling sick as a citizen, you can be able to go to any available hospital and the state will underwrite that transaction. In the same way as I would think that someone who has medical aid and wants to get public healthcare must be able to finance that across healthcare facilities. We need to strengthen health institutions, so hospitals, by appointing the best leadership there. And furthermore, we need to ensure that the modeling of healthcare is also about keeping your citizens healthy, particularly over a long period of time, because the danger here is that what you don't want is to create a model where people up to the age of 60, 65 remain in private healthcare, and then once they stop working, they get dumped into public healthcare at their most vulnerable. So you've got to ensure that people remain within the healthcare facility over a long period of time. And I think prevention in certain instances may be better than cure, as countries like Japan are doing. So what incentives do I put to citizens to stay healthy? What kind of dietary? And we can use technology. People who are on healthcare programs that are sponsored by private medical suppliers, and I don't want to mention names, mm-hmm. get incentives about healthcare, training, exercise, monitoring certain things. We've got to, as a society, begin to build that in and ensure that even what we teach young people to eat, children to eat in schools, how we deal with that keeps them healthy. How do we keep our young people active? How do we ensure that we do as much the preventative part as much as we'll have to deal with the sick South Africans who end up in a public or private care healthcare facility?
I'm assuming it won't just be educating the citizens, but also making sure that you regulate those who supply the food stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely.
In what it is that they give us to eat.
Yeah, and what you don't, it's not about building a paternalistic state, but there are certain practices that we have as a society that are not healthy, you know. Our relationship with alcohol as a society is a problem. I think, you know, you don't have to buy into what took place during COVID, but one of the things that were very clear is that the reduction of alcohol also reduced the number of people who ended up in ICU. So when I go to communities like in various provinces, when I arrive there, it's no doubt the fact that you meet children who not only are suffering from FAS as a function of fetal alcohol syndrome, but you can see that the consumption of alcohol has meant that the burden of disease increases in particular communities. So we've got to think hard about that practice, because I can tell you now, almost as a predictor of behavior, that as soon as it's Friday afternoon in certain communities, people are drunk, violence increases,
emergency,
it puts a burden on healthcare.
Yeah.
So we've got to deal with some of the psychosocial or socioeconomic conditions that society finds itself in order to be able to free up the burden from healthcare.
And finally, why should anyone vote for Bosa?
Because I think, first and foremost, Bosa as a party is the only one that will give power back to the people. We've elected candidates who really are sponsored by their communities, and I can assure you if that candidate stops working, you as the community can remove them. I think that we're the new future-focused party in that, with respect, 2024 is not our 1994. 1994 was a battle of parties who represented races in opposition to a fairly racist system. 2024 is about us writing a chapter post-liberation, and that must be different. We can't be picking parties on the basis of race. I can't go there to express the color of my skin. I must be able to build one South Africa. And then lastly, I myself, personally, you know, to quote the famous poem, you have to be the man in the arena who has felt both defeat and victory. And I've been through both the highs and the lows. I don't come perfect to the public space, but I recognize the fact that I've served in Parliament, I've succeeded, and I've failed at some things. I've worked on things that I failed at, worked at my own leadership, worked on my own academics, worked on my business experience. And so I've assembled an incredible team of South Africans around that I truly believe can take this country forward. And so if you want a party that's led by leaders such as who have not stolen any money, who will make sure that we deliver a job in every home, make sure our young people are educated, is something I deeply care about, and your communities are safe, Bossa is your only option.
You ready to be president?
No one's ever ready, but I'm putting my hand up saying, let's dare lead in this country, because I think it's time for us to bring that change. So no one is perfect in the role, but certainly will bring a set of skills that I think will serve this country well.
It's a question from an ex about you. Are you ready to lead?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm willing and able, and I think whilst not perfect, I'll give my 100% to the service of this country.
Leader of Build One South Africa, Musima Imani, thank you so much for coming through.
My great privilege.
Appreciate it.
If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.